Alaskans, we're still dealing with a pandemic. Longer nights and seasonal affective disorder don't make it any easier. We encourage you to take care of both your mental and physical health this winter. Get outside. Enjoy traditional foods. Connect with your community. And keep your body moving. Let's take care of ourselves and each other.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. Researchers spent years uncovering the names of more than 100 Native students who died at the boarding school in Genoa, Nebraska. They're on a mission to adequately document the true history of the former boarding school. And in Albuquerque, tribal and community leaders are discussing how to adequately memorialize the cemetery from a former residential school there. Right after the news, we'll hear about the process of researching boarding schools to help reconciliation and healing.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders in Southeast Alaska are applauding the Biden administration's move to reinstate protections for the Tungus National Forest, but they warn that the administrative change could be limited to who's in the White House. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently unveiled plans to reverse a Trump administration decision to exempt about 9 million acres from protections that could ease logging and mining on federal forest land. Alaska tribes sued the federal government, saying they were not properly consulted. Organized Village of Cakes tribal president Joel Jackson says the latest announcement is a positive development. His tribe had resisted efforts by the Trump administration and Alaska's governor to open more old forests to logging. But he says his village wants permanent protections.
Yeah, well, this has been a long fight since Trump and Dunleavy overturned the roadless rule. Although it's a win for us to have them reverse it, it's still not what we would hope for the long haul.
A two-month comment period is now underway that will begin the process of restoring roadless rural protections that places restrictions on development. The announcement will also include acknowledgement that the Biden administration will work closer with tribes whose homelands now make up the modern-day Tungus National Forest. The New Mexico Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives Task Force hosted a virtual community education panel Monday. One area of need advocates discussed is education for young people. Jessica Gittadakun-Smith is the education and outreach coordinator for the task force. She sees a need for education materials on the dangers of social media used by traffickers to recruit victims.
There really needs to be education on, you know, an accurate historical multi-generational trauma and what that looks like, and how, you know, that affects our youth and our children still today, and how that makes people more vulnerable to trafficking, and ways to notice red flags, and what, you know, especially with our youth who are on social media and things like that. Because I was groomed into trafficking via Facebook. So I think, you know, that type of curriculum that's really, you know, to the point, like, hey, you gotta watch out there.
Regina Chacon is with the New Mexico Department of Public Safety Missing Persons Clearinghouse.
Build those relationships with the children and let them know that we are safe, that law enforcement is safe to speak to or how to speak to them. Being comfortable around law enforcement and really creating that listening environment. And I think that would benefit all around for the students, for the families, for the parents, having community events, showing up to community events with the schools and to build those relationships.
The nearly two-hour education panel also included testimony from families of missing and murdered relatives. Task Force members address barriers, solutions, and resources. The task force was established in 2019 by New Mexico's governor. It includes tribal, state, and community partners. Five tribes in Maine are working on boosting tribal tourism in the state, the Associated Press reports. They recently received funding of $150,000 from Four Directions Development Corporation. The Wabanaki Cultural Tourism Initiative hopes to create a tourism economy in the next decade. The funding will also help tribal members attend a program for community leaders to build tourism. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
There are now booster recommendations for all three available COVID-19 vaccines in the United States, and you may choose which booster shot you receive. More info at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show. COVID-19 vaccines are approved for kids aged 5 to 11. Vaccines provide kids strong protection against COVID-19 and help keep communities safe. You can schedule their vaccine appointment today. Support by the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. From the Allegheny Territory of the Seneca Nation, I'm Brett Mabee. Researchers with the Genoa Indian School Digital Reconciliation Project recently announced they found 102 names of children who died at the boarding school in Nebraska. By and large, where the remains are remains a mystery. In Albuquerque, the names of those buried at a cemetery associated with the Albuquerque Indian School are not documented. Officials are deciding on the next steps for memorializing the site. This kind of work has already been going on at former boarding school locations in the U.S. for years. Now, Department of Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, who is Laguna Pueblo, is calling for a comprehensive investigation into deaths in boarding schools and those that remain buried there. Coming up, we'll talk about the process of researching and documenting boarding school deaths of Native children as a way to promote healing. We want to hear from you, too. Join us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And then again with Nisadate, the Yetinonio ne Ongwage Chikyao, and Dane Hodine Ongwa Nikotao. Today we honor our ancestors who have passed on, and let it be that way on our minds. And a fair disclaimer that today's topic might include some materials and discussions that some listeners find to be a little disturbing. Joining us from Lincoln, Nebraska, is Judy Gosh Kibas. She is a descendant and survivor of the Genoa Indian Industrial School, executive director of the Nebraska Commission of Indian Affairs, co-chair of the Genoa Indian School Digital Reconciliation Project as well. She's enrolled Ponca and Santee Sioux. Welcome to Native America Calling today, Judy.
Thank you, Brett. It's an honor to be with you.
I'm glad that we could include you in our conversation today. And as we were getting caught up before the show started today, this is tough stuff to talk about. And I hate to even say it that way. These are tough talking points, but they need to be done as well so that we can move forward and heal, not only as Indigenous nations, but as a country as well. So to get started, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this school in Genoa, Nebraska.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The school was the fourth school built in the United States for the purposes of killing the Indian and saving the man. As we know, Carlisle was built in 1879, and that was the same year that Ponca Chief Standing Bear for my tribe was in court, and we were deemed to be humans under the law. But at the same time, we have this campus, a 400-acre school, dormitories for the girls and the boys, and it was a military Pratt Institute like Carlisle. So the children were little. In my view, they were soldiers that answered to a military drill all day long, And in the mornings, they did the 3 R's. In the afternoons, they learned a trade. And they prepared. My mother was a baker, and so she had to bake and make the breads that they ate. The boys did milk the cows. It was a self-sustaining campus. After dinner, they then had some evening time where they had basketball, sports. They were very good athletes. My mother played in the band. So throughout the day, it was a long day starting at 6 in the morning and ending lights out at 9 o'clock. And the children were learning to not be Native, giving up all their cultural identity. It was really, I believe, cultural genocide. And this was the last war fought in America against our people using the children. They were the little warriors. And in wars, some people die and some survive. And I'm so thankful that I'm here today with you, Brett, that my mother was strong enough to somehow get out of the school and go back home to the Ponca Reservation, where she became a tribal councilwoman when white women weren't doing such things. And my two aunts also survived the school. So the intent of the school was to assimilate us and to make us into cookie-cutter Americans. Simultaneously, I believe, it was a deliberate attempt to steal all the lands of America, going parallel to the Dawes Act, to break up our lands and get the lands, and also make sure that the children no longer were connected to their culture and were assimilated. So that's kind of the summary of that, and I, again, am so appreciative that our people, our relatives, were so resilient that in this isolated land separated from their parents all day long and for months and years on end, not going home at Christmas or Thanksgiving, and some were outed in the summer. They worked in the local community with white families. That's a lot to be able to survive. And it's not a boarding school like the nice, fancy boarding schools. Yes, the children wore uniforms that they made, scratchy, itchy uniforms. When they arrived, they cut off their hair. They cut off their connection to my mother and her two sisters were never able to engage in their language at the school. They were separated by tribal identity. It was very purposeful and with intention to do what's being done at the border in America now, separate children from their families. That's how you destroy culture. Take away your language.
I think that's what's so troubling, and I've talked about this before, when you turn on the news and you see dogs and water cannons on water protectors at Standing Rock, and then in the next segment you're seeing kids in cages, and that sends a very clear signal, if you ask me. And so, again, it is important that we talk about this, and not just so we can, you know, remain victimized or anything like that, but more so in an attempt to, I guess, to be able to finally move on so that these things don't repeat again. Right, Judy?
Absolutely. We cannot re-victimize ourselves. We have to be strong, and we have to learn from this, and we have to carry on in our Indian way. And they really, this was a failed experiment that didn't succeed, because we're all here doing these things. I have two daughters and 5 grandchildren. They're alive. One of my daughters is an attorney that does Indian law. My other daughter's a teacher and an artist. The children are the future, and that's what we're here today to talk about. How can we do something to help heal the intergenerational trauma created by the boarding schools? And I heard your segment on missing and murdered Indigenous women. All of that exists because of the dehumanization of the First Peoples. The trial of Standing Bear didn't result in being treated humanely in our country. We still today are invisible people. And this story today is so wonderful that I hope it raises awareness. And I am so appreciative of the efforts of our Secretary Deb Haaland, our first Native leader. I want to help her succeed in unveiling this and doing something good to move forward.
It is certainly my hope that today, throughout our conversation, we can help educate the casual listener as to how this process works, because there are some things to kind of be careful of. As with all things Indigenous, I think we're always constantly walking through a loaded minefield. And this process that we're talking about today is certainly no example. So we'll continue to get deeper into exactly what is going on and how this work is being conducted. I guess to provide a little bit more context, you mentioned that your mother attended this school and your aunts did as well. Where did the children typically come from who attended this school in Genoa?
Genoa had children from all over the United States. And it was a school that was open for 50 years until 1934. My mother went there in the 20s. There were children from Maine, from Blackfeet, Montana, all over. Over 40 tribal nations brought, it was again, get the children as far away from their homelands, from their family. And so they ended up in this little town in Nebraska that most people today don't even know that there was a boarding school there in Genoa. The school has two barns left and the harness building. The cemetery is what we're looking for to try to find. We have the names of most of those children that died, cause of death, but we do not have the cemetery location. So I think that's important to note that there are children from all over the United States, from Oklahoma, from Montana, from Michigan, that went to that school, not just from our four headquarter tribes in Nebraska.
And again, it is important to emphasize that the reason they were sent so far away was to make it that much more difficult for them to make it home, too.
Absolutely. And when the children died, how soon were the families notified? Probably not very timely. Could they afford? Did they have a car? Could they come get the body? Oftentimes not. So they were at a real disadvantage. And a lot of letters never did get to the children. We know that from our digitizing reconciliation research. And you can go to that website and read letters. It's really sad, but I think still empowering to see that these children who were so far away, somehow they bonded with each other and they found a way, those that made it out, to take the best and leave the rest and get out of there. And some didn't do as well. Some, you know, from our records, it looks like some may have attempted suicide. Some were killed as they were running away by the trains. Variety of deaths that are really hard to explain. Children dying of heart failure when they're at most schools, that doesn't happen. And you don't have a cemetery on the property right by your school at private schools around the United States, I don't think.
No, that's typically not a thing, most definitely. Judy, I have a lot more questions for you, and I also am excited to bring our next guest, Dr. Samuel Torres, on as well when we come back from the break. When we do come back, I want to talk about the detective work that you're about as well. And don't forget, we want to hear from you. Do you have a comment or question for today's show? You can call in at 1-800-996-2848. You can also reach out on Facebook at Native America Calling or on Twitter at 1-800-99-NATIVE. We'll get your comments on the air. You're always welcome to post, to pick on Instagram as well at Native America Calling. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm your host, Brett Mabee.
This winter, we welcome in the indigenous artistry of Pixik. When they enter our music circle, they'll tell us more about their latest album, Live from Christ Church Cathedral. Here's some of it. Join us for the next Native America Calling as we visit with our December music makers, Pixik.
I deha tla yi gato ni dagals tanisi sa I. A se no, tlaski yul stoti yi gi hi yela nu da na dega I. Dals du isi, di da na eteti, de zato wito huelo di. Witatla no heta ni ewe a yela nu da na dega an access diski, naski yi ged stela, at healthcare.gov, ale 1-800-318-2596. He a ged to no sa Medicare, ale Medicaid una dalga I.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. Today we're talking about investigating boarding schools. Researchers are working to get a detailed picture of what many Native people already know. hundreds of children died at boarding schools run by religious institutions and the federal government. The names and locations of those children are often missing. You're welcome to join our conversation today by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. In the first segment, we were gracious enough to have Judy Goshkibas of the Genoa Indian School Digital Reconciliation Project provide some context for not only the school at Genoa, but also for the situation with the industrial residential schools throughout the United States and Canada as well. And as we get further into our conversation, in just a few, we'll be hearing from Dr. Samuel Torres. He's the director and research of research and programs for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. But before bringing him on, Judy, I want to get a little bit further into this discussion. You briefly mentioned that you've obviously run into some obstacles, and it seems as though a lot of the records and connections to these children got missing, or they're missing. How did they get broken / erased?
Well, that's a good question. What we have found is that a large bulk of the research has been spent locating the records. They're not all in one location, so that's been a real challenge to our digitizing project. Was it done with deliberate intent? We don't know. Was it a cover-up? We found various records in Kansas City, Denver, and Oklahoma. And there are also additional documents probably in the National Archives headquartered in D.C., but because of and also in Texas. We were somewhat limited in our research recently because of COVID, so we hope that we can resume that research. A lot of the research and the data that we found concerning the 102 children that died there were from local newspapers, various publications. The school itself, the children had a newspaper, so they would report in their own paper, sadly, about fellow students that died. So that's where we accumulated all of this information. And now, unlike Canada, they and Carlisle, they know where the children are, and they have headstones, which was a bit of a humanistic thing to do. In our case, we can't find the cemetery. So we've done two searches thus far with radar, and the analysis on the first search indicated that we hadn't found the cemetery. It was on a farm within the 400 acres of the Genoa campus. So then we went out and did a second radar search, and they did a canal adjacent to that farm. The final research isn't in on that, but the initial appeared that they weren't there. So we're getting ready to do a third radar going back with some new information. We've been contacted by some elderly gentlemen that lived around Genoa that feel that they have some clues that can help us and guide us. We also are going to engage in using dogs. There's a company out of Iowa that has contacted us. And working with the state archaeologist, Rob Bozell, he and I have vetted this company, and so we're bringing them over in addition to the radar in hopes that we'll find where these children are buried. And then from there, we'll have to decide, we'll have a process engaging the tribal nations that the children descend from, notify next of kin to the best that we can, and decide what the plan will be, what we'll do. It's we don't know. So it's kind of like a catch-22. Once we find the cemetery, it could be sadder than... Right now we're sad because we can't find it, and then when we find it, what are we going to do? But I think we need to have closure, and we need to have a way to honor those that lost their lives there, have some type of a memorial, maybe through the federal initiative. There can be funding for language revitalization or for money to go to the Genoa Indian School Foundation so that they can improve their messaging and make it more reflecting of the truth of what happened there. And the foundation has existed for 30 years, and they've done a good job over the years of having reunions of the living descendants. I've attended those for many, many years and met elders that survived, and they'd come back year after year. So they told stories, and that was really wonderful to me. having lost my mother when I was 19 years old, I learned stories through those descendants. But the foundation is a volunteer organization that doesn't have funding to really do justice to the history. So it's time now for us to tell the history and get the federal government to support that. The burden shouldn't be on the tribal people and those that lost their lives. I hope that the Interior finds funding that will empower us and NABS and everybody involved to do something meaningful that will enlighten all of America to the truth of this story. And I always say, if we can talk about Anne Frank with children in school, we can talk about Genoa and Carlisle and all of those 350-plus Indian boarding schools in America.
Judy, that just might be the quote of the day for me, and I think that's something to definitely keep in mind. And you're absolutely right. Before my illustrious radio broadcasting career took off, I spent some time as a land surveyor for my tribe, for the Seneca Nation, and I was able to help out the Tribal Historic Preservation Office one day and kind of be a monitor on a site on something kind of similar. One of our chiefs, Gayasondo, was down in the Pennsylvania region, and it's well documented that in the 1800s, his grave was looted and was moved over time. So they brought in this radar that you're talking about, and I want to spend just a couple minutes talking about what GPR is, this ground-penetrating radar, and especially I want to highlight what you were mentioning with this company that you're bringing in and the need for people to be aware to not just trust anybody with this GPR, because there does have to be an exact method to how this survey is carried out as well, correct?
Yes, we don't want to be exploited by anyone that's out there thinking they can take advantage of us. So that's why over the years I've worked with Rob Ozell, and we have a good relationship, and we did good vetting, and we're not going to be bamboozled by some people out there. We're pretty smart Indians these days.
Well, I think that's the thing. I know you've been about this work for a while, but I feel like we can highlight this so that others aren't exploited in that kind of a manner. I was reading a little bit about the need for peer reviews and to really be responsible with how this data is used. So, Judy, I have a few more questions for you before our time is done. At this time, joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota, is Dr. Samuel Torres. He's the Director of Research and Programs for the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. He's Mexica and Nahua. Welcome to Native American Calling, Sam.
I'm grateful to be on the line here with you today. Thank you.
I'm glad that I heard of you through my brother-in-law, Patrick, who you worked with down at Carlisle, and I became intrigued hearing about that experience, and hats off to anybody who is engaged in this work on a continual basis, because it's not easy. And Dr. Torres, I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of a background on the kind of research that you're doing.
Absolutely. I'd be glad to. I've been with the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition for a few years now, but the work of the coalition has predated my presence here. We started in 2011, which was really in response to the public outcry about the lasting effects of the boarding school era shortly after Canada launched their TRC, their Truth and Reconciliation Commission program in 2010. Our mission has been to lead in the pursuit of understanding and addressing the ongoing trauma created by the U.S. Indian boarding school policy. So, of course, situated deeply foundationally in that has been to center the truth in that history. And I think it's really important to look at how critical that notion of history being not only something that is in the past, but that is an ongoing present reality. We carry our history with us, and we are our history. And I think it's really important to bring into this discussion the work of Dr. Maria Yellowhorse Braveheart, who talks about the process of moving forward from historical trauma and intergenerational trauma. And the first component of that is confronting that historical trauma. In order to move forward, we have to understand the trauma and release the pain and transcend the trauma. But of course, central to that is confronting it. And I think one of the things in the settler colonial government, you know, in the lands now known as the United States, collectively, societally, politically, we have not done a good job of centering this truthful history. And this history has largely been swept under the rug. So the research that the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition has been tasked with, essentially, was one that emerged from this, and actually initially it started as a request to the federal government from our organization to respond to certain questions like how many boarding schools that were in operation, how many children attended, how many of those that didn't make it that passed away in these institutions. And while they didn't initially respond to us, they actually didn't respond to that request until an independent journalist reached out to them and asked about that FOIA request. And they replied with a simple, they don't do that type of research for folks. And so, illuminated by that fact, we took it upon ourselves to work with a series of researchers, both as staff of NABS or contract researchers, and in some cases volunteer researchers, to compile an authoritative list and to determine more descriptive points such as years of operation, how many tribal nations were affected, and in what, you know, what areas of the country children came from in order to go to these institutions, what denominations, Christian denominations that ran these institutions, and of course where their records are located. As Judy mentioned, it's often very difficult to determine precisely where those records are. They often come from different places. They are sometimes scattered, incomplete, and really limited for a variety of different reasons. But those records can detail, death, disease, and they can often put individual names and locations, and it can be quite useful for descendants to learn more about their relatives. So one of our research initiatives, beyond simply just identifying how many institutions, and we've identified 367 institutions to this point, a number that has over the years fluctuated a bit with the the increasing volume of efforts and resources and staff to be able to devote towards those inquiries. But we understand that primary source documents are and have been really helpful for relatives to be able to learn more about that. And so working with Judy and the folks at the Genoa Indian School Digital Reconciliation Project, as well as other institutions that are doing similar projects, we are working towards creating sort of a clearinghouse, a digital archive where relatives can log on and access those records to also preserve them, as many of these documents are over 100 years old. But in a digital repository, at being able to access the historical record of these institutions, quite frankly, helps to illuminate the consequences of these historical institutional abuses, as well as longstanding repercussions on Native communities.
Dr. Torres, we're talking a little bit about how these files becoming accessible are able to help descendants learn about their ancestors. And that was certainly the case at the Carlisle School. I think a lot of their archives are available online. I was able to learn about my great-grandfather, Gibson Black Chief, who served in World War I, attended there. He something happened. He absolutely refused to go back. And I think health kind of played a factor into that. But one last question before we bring on our next guest. Dr. Torres, do you find varying degrees of, obviously not everybody is keeping as good records as what was happening at Carlisle, correct?
I think, yeah, it's a varying reality of how well records were kept. And in certain cases, like in the federal off-reservation boarding schools like Carlisle and Genoa, records were often kept really well. And in some cases, in some denominations, some Catholic denominations' records were, you know, some orders were really meticulous with record keeping. One of the great obstacles, though, with working toward preserving and acquiring some records with some Christian denominations is that those records aren't in the public domain. They are kept in private collection, as they are not a government entity. So one of the things that we have been very adamant on supporting folks seeking truth and healing, both Native and non-Native communities, is that within those that are connected to church denominations, one of the things that we believe is central to moving towards healing is urging your Christian communities and those denominations that ran certain boarding schools to push towards making those records accessible. We're able to access certain files in National Archives and Records Administration's buildings across the country. There are currently 9 of them. And, of course, as Judy mentioned, because of COVID has been somewhat of a challenge, they have been closed for almost 2 years now and have had very limited foot traffic. But we are working with them and trying to determine a safe plan in order to go in and to be able to of course, scan and digitize certain documents to see what they have. And as you mentioned, the level of quality, the level of bookkeeping and record keeping does vary. Carlisle certainly set a framework, a blueprint down for what that can look like. And I'm so glad that it has been helpful and beneficial to you, Brett, to be able to learn more about your relatives. There are 366 other institutions, as we know, and perhaps even more. And we hope to be able to allow that same level of access to people that want to learn more about their family's history.
Most definitely. Thank you very much for your insight, Dr. Torres. Of course, as we've beginning this idea today, what's happening at Genoa is one of many places where this kind of research is going on. When we come right back from the break, we'll be bringing on Terry Sloan, an intergovernmental tribal liaison in the city of Albuquerque. We have to head to a short break, but we'll be right back. Don't forget, we want to hear from you. Call in at 1-800-99-NATIVE. We have to take a quick break. I'm your host, Brett Mabee.
Mesalands Community College can help you lead the way in your chosen field. At Mesalands, where 1 in 3 students is Native American, you get hands-on opportunities working one-on-one with instructors in wind energy, where students go up the turbine in their first semester, silversmithing with access to the largest foundry in the Southwest, and blacksmithing in the cowboy arts. Mesalands has a national top 10 rodeo team, too. Info and applications at mesalands.edu. Mesalands Community College supports this program.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. We're talking about investigating former boarding schools. Is there forensic or historical work being done at a boarding school that has connections to your Native community? There's still time to join our conversation. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is Terry Sloan. He's the City of Albuquerque Intergovernmental Tribal Liaison. He's Diné and Hopi. Welcome to Native America Calling, Terry.
Yate, Diné, Brett. It is an honor for me to speak to you today from the traditional homelands of the Tiwa Pueblo people. Thank you for having me.
I apologize for taking so long to get to you. I feel like we could have extended conversations with each of our guests, and all of your insight today is so vital to what this conversation is and how it connects all of our communities together. And as I was saying before the break, this kind of detective work is going on all over Indian country right now, and you're about this in Albuquerque right now. I was wondering if you could give us a little background on what's already known about the cemetery there for the Albuquerque Indian School.
Thank you, Brett, and I agree there's a lot happening around the country. But what we found out, we knew about the Albuquerque Indian School burial site, cemetery back in the probably since Albuquerque started in the 1800s, et cetera, the Presbyterian Church started the Indian School back in 1881 and worked it through 1891. And since the Albuquerque, city of Albuquerque itself first began working on the site back in the 1970s, where we created a park from the cemetery itself. The actual Indian School itself continues. It actually used to be here in Albuquerque, and then in the 1980s, it moved to Santa Fe, which is where it's now the Santa Fe Indian School. So we've had it for over 100 years in the state of New Mexico.
Terry, and what is the latest on your work with this 4-H park in Albuquerque?
What we're moving forward with right now is we're going to begin to do some ground-penetrating radar. And we have hired a group that will be conducting this technical GPR work for us. We are going to be hosting, we have hosted meetings with stakeholders that included Native American organizations, individuals, and representatives of the Native community here in Albuquerque. And then we will be hosting a meeting with the tribal departments and tribes this week. And we just got confirmed last night that the Navajo Nation will have 7 representatives at our meeting this week. And so we will be also hosting public meetings in January, starting on January 11th through 14th. And our first meeting will actually be an in-person meeting where we hope to hear from the public and collect data or any information that they may have on the Albuquerque Indian School. But like everybody else, we are continuing to have problems finding information. There was, as far as we know and understand, there was a fire and a flood at the original Albuquerque Indian School and also at the Santa Fe Indian School where records were lost. So we're in the process of doing our own forensics on the data to try to find information what we can. But we did find some information at the Presbyterian Church here in Albuquerque, where I actually did go and look at their historical archives, and we did obtain some information on the number of students over the years, and also the number that passed between the time period 1881 and 1891. 7 actually died at the school, and 16 died at their homes, and then 7 died elsewhere. So we continue to do that, the research to get the information we need to have, so we can better, I guess, determine what we're going to do with the site itself. Hope that answers your question.
Most definitely. And I think, you know, this is the sense that I'm getting is that, you know, it's always an ongoing, evolving kind of landscape that you have to work with, just shifting sets of circumstances. So that definite need to ebb and flow with this work. I want to throw this out there right now. There's still time to join our conversation for today's show. You can call in at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're going to head to the phone lines right now. Listening in Buffalo Springs, New Mexico on KUNM, I'd like to welcome Mike to Native America Calling today. Mike, the microphone's yours.
Brett, it's been a while. I guess you're the new host. And I was just wanted to comment that I attended boarding school on one of the oldest boarding schools and the first boarding school on the Navajo Nation in a little community north of Gallup, New Mexico, on 491 called Tehachi. It was a Tehachi boarding school. And I attended that boarding school and started in 1962. And we didn't suffer the discipline that like at Carlisle and a lot of the other places, but it was, we did go through a lot of discipline, though. One thing I did gain out of that was I really learned how to march really well, if anything, so that fast forward in 75 when I was in Fort Hood, Texas, and Fort Knox, Kentucky, they commented, other soldiers commented that I knew how to march pretty good and stuff, and I told them, I said, that's because of the boarding school. I marched everywhere, dining hall, to class, even on the weekends when they had doings going on in the main building. We all went there and we all marched around and stuff like that. So that's one thing I got out of the boarding school is how to march really well. And in 2016, I was walking by and something was amiss when I was walking because I lost most of my sight and 2009, and I was walking by the new clinic that I helped build also, but I was walking by and I felt something amiss, and I stopped and looked to my left, and I was like, oh, good gravy, what happened? The whole boarding school that I was, all four dormitories, including the IHS hospital, the kitchen, the old infirmary area that burned down, it was all wiped out. It was all gone. Nothing but leveled out pile of rocks. And that was the boarding school I attended. And I know as far as burial sites and stuff like that, there's none out there that I know of. But I do know about the Albuquerque. I read about that and listened to Native American calling about that. And there's the burial site I read in the Albuquerque Journal, that part of this burial site is underneath what they call the Laguna Burger, is built on top of it right next to the Culture Center. And so that was the city, and they allowed that to all be built, even though I'm sure they had knowledge of such a thing being underneath. Anyway, I just share that with you.
Well, thank you very much for your thoughts today and joining our conversation, Mike. We honor you, and we honor all survivors of the boarding schools, always as well. I do have time for another caller listening in Santee, Nebraska on KZYK. I'd like to welcome Melvin to Native America Calling today.
Good morning. I love your conversation. You know, my grandparents went to Genoa. That's where they met, was at the boarding school. And I asked my grandpa, what you guys do around Genoa? They said, we worked all the time. That infrastructure for all those small towns around the school, the kids built that. They dug all those holes and trenches. It was kind of like that Shawshank Redemption thing where they had that illegal, they were getting paid, but the kids weren't getting paid. A lot of that went on, especially for these small towns, because it was cheap labor, those kids. And I said to my grandpa, well, how many towns you go to do all that work? He said, six. We dug up every street, and put water lines in and sewer lines. So a lot of these schools were no more than work farms that was exploited by the local communities. And Genoa was just as bad, you know. But I'm thankful that my grandparents survived. The other thing is, I was talking to one of them Eastmans up at Flandreau, and he was telling me how many never came back. The numbers that got on the train, went to Genoa, and he figured about 30-some percent never made it home. Now, that's a very high number, because there was hundreds of kids at that boarding school. I think we need to talk more about what happened to all these kids that we can't account for. You know?
Melvin, your comments are spot on. In fact, that was the work ethos that Pratt embodied and set forth. Dr. Torres was mentioning how Carlisle kind of set the precedent, and I believe our other guests were also commenting on something similar, that work was the answer to all the Indian problem, if you will. Judy, I want to bring back to you right now. Is this what you're finding a lot with the Genoa School, similar to what Melvin's grandparents went through?
Absolutely. They thought that our children were basically, laborers. They didn't think that we could learn anything. It was manual service, being indentured servants for them to do the work that they didn't want their children to do. They didn't think we could become doctors, attorneys, and teachers, et cetera, which we know that we could. So it was, as Melvin said, cheap labor, and the children learned a hard work ethic. I think that many probably, that's what got them out of there, Alvin's grandparents, my mother and my aunties. And my mother baked rolls to keep us alive till a week before she died, my 10 brothers and sisters. So I'm glad she learned that. But it's sad that they didn't get to do other things. And Mike's saying about marching, they were little soldiers that marched everywhere. And I myself, I'm a product of that. I'm a soldier, and I parent that way, and it goes on in your blood. It's in your DNA. And I was in the marching band, so I too was marching, and it wasn't a peaceful, happy, low-key place to go to school. It was really rigid, like being in the military. And so a lot of our men and women went on to serve our country because this is our homeland. There's no place for us to go back to. My Santee grandmother went to the Santee Normal Training School, and I'm thankful that she got to stay there and not have to go away. And she got, her language was intact. She got to see her mother in the evening. But this was a whole different place that was intended to separate the children from the family, destroy the culture, use them for whatever they felt was necessary. And now America has hidden this history. It's buried along with the children we're trying to find. So I want everyone, all of my colleagues, Dr. Therese Nabbs, Secretary of Interior, you, Brett, to help us to bring these stories out of the ground and up to be informing everyone about futures policy funding for Indian Health Service. And we, as Indian people, the first people, honor our treaties, honor the funding that is necessary. Don't put the burden of proof on the boarding schools, the descendants, to find their relatives and that. But find the federal monies. The federal government did this. They have to find a way to take us out to the healing that we deserve.
That is most definitely their responsibility as well. And an important point in this conversation, I think. And Judy, just kind of wrapping up what you were saying there, we are still having to overcome that disconnect between our cultural self and the modern world. And in fact, that's a lot of what we're trying to reconcile now. We're always talking about education reforms that are helping to address this. And, that's some of what we have to be excited about as well. Terry, I have time for one last question from you as well. Why is this kind of work so important to you?
First, Brett, I'd like to respond to Mike's comment about the Laguna Burger being on grave sites. That is actually inaccurate information. The Indian Public Cultural Center, which helped develop that area, did extensive research on the land before they developed that into a commercial complex. And then we know and we have information on where the grave site is, so we know it's not in that region. And this information dates back to the 1800s when it was created. So I just want to make sure. It's kind of an urban myth, but that's not true, because we have worked with IPCC on this burial site work. But for me, it's important. And the city of Albuquerque and our native indigenous constituents, that we find out, who is there, if there is somebody there, our past relatives, our sacred, youth and children, and it is important enough for us to also find and get that healing and reconciliation that is needed for this atrocity that occurred to our Native Indigenous peoples throughout the country.
Thank you so much for your insights today, Terry, Dr. Torres, and Judy as well. We've officially reached the end of the hour. It always goes too fast, as I was afraid it would. I'd like to say thank you once again to our guests, Judy Goshpgosh, also Samuel Torres and Terry Sloan. Be sure to join us tomorrow for our Music Maker highlight. Tara Gatewood is talking to the sister duo, Pixic. I'm Brett Mabee.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme. Support by the Sioux Trading Post, whose special selection of dried herbs are chosen for superior quality, and many sage, sweetgrass braids, and red willow bark and cedar are wild-crafted. All available at SiouxTrading.com. Wopila. COVID-19 vaccines are approved for kids aged 5 to 11. Vaccines provide kids strong protection against COVID-19 and help keep communities safe. You can schedule their vaccine appointment today. Support by the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.